slipped, and the faint sheen of tears glimmered in her eyes. After a few seconds, she reopened her eyes and smiled. The same calm, open smile he knew he would miss a great deal. "Excellent news, Aloysius," she said. "Thank you for telling me. And when can we expect our queen's arrival?" Aloysius flicked his eyes at the free sword outside. The man might appear dumb as a stump, and capable of no more than a few words of realm tongue, but Aloysius's short spying career had taught him the value of seeing beyond appearances. "Such intelligence is far beyond my reach, Aspect." He folded his arms and extended three fingers towards his elbow, seeing understanding in her gaze as she resisted the impulse to nod. "It is my belief you should not save the wine," she said in brisk tone. "These are troubled times, and wine always offers an escape from worry, don't you think?" "You are kind to think of my comfort, Aspect. But if ever a man has drunk his fill, it's me." The free sword gave an impatient jangle of his keys, and Aloysius stood. "Though I am able to share two bottles with you," Aloysius told her, "your own comfort being of paramount importance to me." Her smile faltered a little, a stern glint appearing in her gaze. "Wine should not be wasted, Aloysius."
"And it won't be."
He knelt, meeting her eyes, seeing how she fought tears. Instead of raising her hand for him to kiss, as was their habit, she leaned forward and pressed her lips to his forehead, whispering, "I beg you, go." He clasped her hands and kissed them, standing and moving from the cell. He was careful in his scrutiny of the free sword as he locked the door, seeing only the dull eyes of a brutal fool. Nevertheless, he was glad he had told Cressida to kill him the instant she entered this chamber. It was the one house he had never visited since the city's fall. A part tumbled down, once impressive mansion near Watcher's Bend, shaded by the branches of a great old oak. The roof was even more threadbare than he remembered, and the windows were all gone, stirring memories of how hard Alornis had worked to keep them clean and intact. Their house had been spared burning by some happy chance, perhaps because of its size or the barren rooms within, void of any useful loot, at least to those unskilled in spotting concealment. The door was half off its hinges, the hallway beyond all peeling paint and bare floorboards. He remembered his first visit here, the falsely confident knock she took so long to answer. "Aloysius Alhestian, my lady," he had greeted her, bowing low. "Former comrade to your noble brother." "I know who you are," she replied, with a puzzled frown, opening the door only wide enough to look him up and down. "What do you want?" It had taken several visits before she let him in, and only then because it had been raining, pointing him to a stool in the kitchen with a stern warning against dripping on her drawings. It had been duty that made him persist, the appearance of adherence to a royal command, but it was the drawings that made him come back the next night, suffering her puzzled indifference and occasional barbs. He had never seen anything like them, the clarity and feeling rendered with such economy, as irresistible as he came to find their creator. He made his way to the kitchen, where she had spent most of her time, the floor tiles liberally adorned with broken crockery, the table where she prepared the meagre meals they shared tipped over and lacking a leg. "Protect me?" she had laughed when he explained his reason for coming here every night. Her eyes went to the short sword at his belt, twinkling a little. "I'm sorry, but that really doesn't suit you." "No," he admitted, "it never did. But thanks to your brother, I do know how to use it." In truth, he always knew she needed little protection. Those few faithful sufficiently deluded to imagine her some kind of substitute for her brother were sent away with implacable and waspish refusal, whilst the king never had reason to suspect her loyalty. She worked every day under Master Benrel's less than pleasant tutelage, and spent her nights in this empty house, her charcoal and silver point crafting wonders from the parchment she starved herself to buy. It was parchment that bought her toleration, for he always had an ample supply, and would bring some when he came, content to sit and watch as she worked, a bottle of wolf's blood never far away despite her obvious disapproval. "Every word she speaks regarding her brother and her father is to be recorded," Malcius had told him that day he had been called to the palace, ostensibly to receive the Queen's endorsement of his latest collection of poems, but in reality to press him to a new duty. Narcissa's face had been grave as they walked together in the gardens, a king forced to reluctant necessity. The identity of any and all visitors also. Lord Valen's shadow was ever far too long, Lucius. Best if she's not caught in it, don't you think? He thought he was making me a spy, Lucius mused, glancing at the wall where she had pinned her sketches, bare now save for the outline of parchment on whitewash. Little knowing the Maldinians had got there first. Poor old Malcius. Janice would have known in an instant. He climbed the creaking and partly missing stairs to the upper floor, 27 following, hopping the gaps with nimble swiftness. He paused only a little at the door to Alornis's room, as he had done at the end of many a drunken night, just to catch the soft whisper of her breath as she slept. Why did I never tell her? He wondered. Words spoken so easily to so many others, but I could never say them to her, the one time they would have been true. The room where he had slept was mostly intact, his narrow bed still sitting against the wall complete with mattress, though the sheets were gone. He pulled it away from the wall and knelt, dislodging a fragment of plaster to reveal a small hiding place, missed by the Valerians who had come looting. He sighed in relief at finding the narrow leather bundle intact. "Doesn't seem much, does it?" he said to 27, placing the bundle on the bed and undoing the ties, revealing a small dagger. The handle was undecorated whalebone and the sheath plain leather. He drew it, bearing a well-made blade 6 inches long. "But," he went on, "the man who gave it to me said the barest touch is enough to kill. Not instantly, but the poison on the blade will ensure a swift death." He met the slave's eyes, something he rarely did because there was nothing there to see. "What would you do if I tried to stab you with this? Kill me? I doubt it. Disarm me, more likely. Break my wrist, perhaps. Or would you, I wonder, simply stand there and die, sure in the knowledge that I'll find another just like you at my side before the day's out?" 27 stared at him and said nothing. "Don't worry, my good friend." Lucius returned the dagger to its sheath and pushed it into his belt. "It's not for you. Besides, I find I've grown too fond of your company, your conversation being such a delight." He pushed the bed against the wall and settled onto it, lying back with his hands behind his head. "How many battles have you seen? 10, 20, 100? "I was in a battle once. Well, 3 times if you count the Bloody Hill and Marbellus, though my part was hardly worthy of note. No, my one true battle was in the Usurper's Revolt, the High Keep, the first great victory in the illustrious career of our soon-to-be deliverer. There are songs about it, awful and dreadfully inaccurate, but I'm in them, most of them anyway. Lucius the poet-warrior, come to avenge his brother, his sword like lightning from a righteous storm." He fell silent for a moment, remembering. It was always the smell and the sound he recalled best, much more vivid in his mind than the images, which were just a red-tinged jumble. No, it was the sound of horses screaming, the stink of sweat, the odd crunch steel makes when it pierces flesh, voices begging their god for deliverance, and shit, the acrid, stinging perfume of his own shit. "I made him teach me," he told 27. "On the march. Every night we'd practice. I got better, good enough to fool myself I had some kind of chance, some hope of surviving what was coming. I knew I was wrong when Malcius ordered the charge. Knew in an instant I was no warrior, no avenging soul, just a scared boy with shit in his trews. I remember screaming. I suppose the others thought it a war cry, but it was just fear. When we charged the gate, they sought to bar our entry with their bodies, linking arms, shouting prayers to their god. When we struck home, the force of it sent me flying. I tried to get up, but there were so many bodies pressing me down. I screamed, and I begged, but no one pulled me free. Then something hard came down on my head." He remembered the kindly sister who had nursed him back to health, later destined to find herself in the black hold for heresy and treason, all because she spoke against the war. He remembered his father's face the day he returned to the mansion, the sigh of relief followed by a curt order. "You will not venture again from this house without my consent." He had nodded meekly, handed back Lyndon's sword, and gone to his room where he had stayed for the best part of a year. "I have always been a coward, you see," he said. "And the more I learn of this world, I find it the only sensible course in life, for the most part. At Marbellus I stood and watched a city burn, then watched my father hang 100 men for burning it. I stayed at his side throughout the siege, even when he led a charge to seal a breach in the defences. Didn't shit myself that time, though I was very drunk. When the walls fell, I ran when he ran. Darnell was there, oddly enough, just as terrified as the rest of us. I remember he had to fight his own men to get to the ship that took us to safety, and when we sailed away, I looked at his face and knew him to be every bit the coward I am." He turned to 27, beckoning him closer and speaking softly. "I need you to remember something." He spoke for a short time, the words unrehearsed but flowing well. When he was finished, he ordered 27 to repeat them, the slave doing so in a disconcertingly precise imitation of Lucius's voice. "Is my accent really that mannered?" he wondered when the slave fell silent. "Very good," he said, then gave careful instruction regarding when and to whom his words were to be repeated. "I'll sleep now," he told 27. "Wake me by the 8th bell, if you would." He was gratified to find Darnell on horseback at the docks, his few remaining knights clustered about him on foot. The fieflord was ever keen to tower above those around him, and insisted on riding whenever he ventured from the palace. A full battalion of free swords was lined up along the wharf behind Mervac, waiting to greet whatever luminaries approached on the huge warship now cresting the horizon. Lucius knew from his father the Valerian supply convoys had been subject to frequent attack in recent weeks. The Meldinians no doubt happy to find piracy as profitable an endeavour in war as in peace. However, a ship possessing the size and power of the monster sailing towards them could surely expect to remain immune from their attentions. Lucius had spent the morning in expectation of some great commotion, men rushing to man his father's carefully laid positions as Lerna's army appeared on the southern plain. But there had been no alarm, no warning trumpets to pierce the morning air, and no armies to besmirch the surrounding country. "If she could have come, she would," he knew, "if only to hang me." He had been keen to avoid her since the war, her scrutiny being ever so acute, their meetings limited to the occasional palace function. There had been times when she sent messengers requesting his attendance at luncheon, but he had always demurred, fearing what her insight might tell her. "I know what you did, Lerna." It had begun the day he returned from Marbellus, and she came to the docks to greet the feeble remnants of her father's once great army. Her smile perfect, grave, encouraging, free of judgment or reproach. But he saw it, just for an instant, as she watched the realm guard with a missing leg being carried from the ship. Guilt. It had all tumbled into place later, an instantaneous realization when he learned their new king was safely returned to the realm, and Valen taken by the Alpirans. He had been at the palace when Malcius, pale-eyed and gaunt beneath his beard, placed the crown upon his head, and the assembled nobles bowed. And Lerna's face betrayed the same flicker of expression he had seen that day at the docks. "I know what you did." He had always marvelled at how quickly the Meldinians found him. Drink, women, and the occasional flurry of poetry had been his chief distractions in the 2 years since Marbellus, liquor making him somewhat incautious with his words, words that some might take as sedition. The Meldinian had sat down next to him one night, in his favourite wine shop, so favoured because the first cup was always free for veterans, a small expense since they were so few in number. The Meldinian wore the garb of a sailor, as befitted his nationality, speaking initially in coarse, uncultured tones. He bought wine for Lucius, professing himself ignorant of letters upon hearing his occupation, but asked many questions about the war. He came back the following night, buying less wine but asking more questions, and the night after that. With every meeting, Lucius noted his accent was not so coarse as before, and his questions more searching, especially regarding the king and his sister.
"They're traitors," Eleusis had said, a little too loud from the way the man winced and gestured for him to speak softer. "The whole family," he went on, knowing he was far too drunk and not caring. "Janus sent my brother to die in the Martiche, had my father slaughter thousands for nothing, abandoned my friend to the Alpirans. She did that, not Janus. It was her." The Maldinian gave a slow nod.
"We know," he said, "but we'd like to know more."
They offered him money, which he refused, proud of himself for being sober when he did so.
"Just tell me what you want."
Spying, he discovered, was an absurdly easy occupation. Few people ever see more than they wish to, he decided, having accepted an invitation to read poetry to a gaggle of merchants' wives, rich in gossip and fat with information regarding the new trade routes their husbands had been obliged to forge since the war. They saw a handsome young poet, tragic hero of a tragic war, wilted obligingly at his verse, and proved very helpful when he asked for likely investment opportunities. "For my father, you understand, he needs something to occupy him these days. Peacetime is such a trial for a military man." He would go to inns frequented by the realm guard, finding welcome among the veterans who had been at Linesh with Valin, embittered cynics to a man, and talkative when sufficiently full of ale. He made it known he was available for commissions, penning love poems for smitten young nobles, and eulogies for the funerals of rich men, gaining access to the wealthy and the powerful in the process. His Maldinian contact was happy with his work, and provided the pigeons to speed delivery of his intelligence, and the dagger, should he ever face discovery.
"I'm not an assassin," Eleusis told him, eyeing the dagger with distaste.
"It's for you," the Maldinian told him with a grin before walking from the wine shop. Eleusis never saw him again. The following week came the summons from the king, and his order to spy on Alornis, after which he found his enthusiasm for his new occupation began to wane. Being with her dimmed his anger, made the sting of betrayal less acute. He continued to gather information, mostly trade gossip of little value, sending the birds off and knowing, should he include his notice of retirement among the messages, the Maldinians were more likely to offer a blade than a pension. As it turned out, the Valerians made such worries redundant. Eleusis stood with 27 some 10 yards behind his father, who had positioned himself outside Darnell's coterie of sycophant knights.
"Impressive beast, isn't it?" he asked, moving to stand on his father's left.
Lacryl Alhestian nodded as the ship came closer, Eleusis seeing two smaller vessels following in its broad wake.
"Apparently it's the sister ship to their Stormspite," his father said.
"I forget the name. Mervec thinks it's a sign of the ruling council's continued faith in his command, bringing more reinforcements than expected."
Eleusis remembered the Stormspite as a brooding monster that had sat in the harbour for days until General Tokrif sailed it off to Altor, never to return. Picking out details as its sister came closer, he was struck by the similarity between them. Even for ships built to the same pattern, the resemblance was striking, though the Valerians were a people greatly fond of uniformity.
"Are your preparations complete?" he asked. "All made ready to bleed Lord Valin's army white?"
"Hardly," his father grunted. "The free swords are lazy when not set to pillaging, and the Varitai little use in labour. Give them a shovel, and they just stare at it. Still, it seems we'll shortly have more hands to complete the task."
"Could you have held Marbellus, if you had had this much to work with?"
Lacryl turned to him with a quizzical expression. It was an unspoken understanding that Marbellus was a subject neither of them wanted to discuss.
"No," he said.
There must have been something in Eleusis's expression, some vestige of his intent, for he leaned closer, speaking softly.
"You don't need to be here, Eleusis, and you've yet to produce a single useful word from the aspects." His eyes flicked to Darnell. "I can't protect you forever."
Eleusis's gaze went to his stolen house, finding the balcony where he ate breakfast and counted the ships every morning. She was there as requested, a small, plump figure,
leaning on the balustrade, her gaze fixed on Darnell, or rather Darnell's horse.
"It's all right," Aloysius told his father. "You won't have to."
Darnell's horse gave a loud snort, jerking and shaking its head.
"Easy now," the fieflord said, smoothing his hand over its neck.
Aloysius was relieved to see Darnell wore no armour today, just finely tailored silks and a long cloak. He reached for the dagger at the small of his back, concealed beneath his coat, his eyes intent on Darnell's horse. It snorted again, giving a loud whinny, eyes widening into panicked mania as it reared, too sudden for Darnell to grab a tighter hold of the reins, pitching him from the saddle. Free of its rider, the great warhorse wheeled around, lashing out with its hooves at the nearest of Darnell's knights, the iron shoes ringing loud on the man's breastplate as they sent him sprawling. The animal pivoted on its forelegs, vicious hind hooves scattering the remaining knights as Darnell backpedaled on the ground, eyes wide in panic. The horse stopped its assault on the knights and turned again, wild eyes fixing on 27 before charging with a shrill scream. The slave elite's expression remained as calm as ever as he attempted to dive clear of the horse's path, proving fractionally too slow as the animal's flank collided with his shoulder, spinning him to the ground, slack and senseless. Aloysius drew the dagger from its sheath and sprinted towards Darnell, now climbing to his feet, well clear of any protection.
"Only use the shortest possible thrust," Velen had told him all those years ago when he fancied himself a hero. "It's the fast blade that draws blood."
Some battle-won instinct must have sounded in Darnell's mind, for he turned just as Aloysius thrust towards his back, the blade piercing his cloak and becoming entangled in the folds. Darnell snarled, bringing his fist around to smash at Aloysius's face. He ducked under it, tearing the dagger free of the cloak and lunging for Darnell's arm, knowing even the slightest cut would be enough. The fieflord sidestepped, his sword coming free of its scabbard in a blur. Aloysius felt a great stinging burn flare across his chest, the shock of it sending him to his knees. Darnell looming above him, sword drawn back. His expression was fiercely triumphant, smile broad in anticipation of the kill.
"You think to kill me, little poet?" he laughed.
"No," Aloysius replied, feeling blood bathing his chest as he glanced over Darnell's shoulder.
"But I expect he will."
Darnell whirled, but too late. Lacryl Alhestian speared the fieflord through the neck with a spike protruding from his right sleeve. Darnell took some seconds to die, spitting blood and weeping as he hung from the spike, eyes bulging and lips babbling gibberish before he finally slumped to the wharf. Aloysius still thought it hadn't taken long enough. A cold hand seemed to enfold him on all sides as he collapsed, feeling his father catch him, smiling up at his ice-white face. "The aspects," he said.
"Get to the black hold."
"Aloysius!"
His father shook him, his voice a rage-filled scream. "Aloysius!"
Aloysius was aware of a great clamour somewhere, though his vision was too dim to make out the source. Men yelling in alarm and summoning memories of the high keep. He found it strange that the sky above his father's head seemed to be filled with black streaks, like the arrows at the bloody hill. Another unwelcome memory. He closed his eyes, pushing it all away and filling his mind with Alornish's face as the last of his blood seeped away.
Chapter 11. Frentis.
"Winterfall Eve," Brother Lerniel said in his perennially dull voice.
He had said almost nothing since arriving with the Airhill woman the day before, slumping in front of a fire and staring at the flames for hours. Insha Carforna stayed at his side, her gaze continually drawn in expectation.
"The Seventh Order," Ivern said, watching with Frentis from the fringes of the gathered captains, his face a mix of confusion and suspicion. "Hiding in the Realm Guard. And where else, one wonders?"
"Aspec Grelin gave the impression they had many guises," Frentis said.
"Grelin?" Ivern shook his head. "Just how many lies did they tell us, do you think?"
"Enough to keep us safe."
Frentis straightened as Brother Lernor said something, and Insha Carforna raised a hand to beckon him over.
"What happens on Winterfall Eve?" Banders asked the brother.
"Varenshold,"
Lerniel frowned in concentration, a vein pulsing in his temple, and sweat beading his brow. Lord Alsorna attacks Varenthold. Something will happen.
Alsorna's army is in Warnsclave, Vander said. How could he make such an attack?
Lerniel gave a pained grunt, arching his back and exhaling slowly, then slumping forward, features slack with exhaustion.
That's all, he muttered.
There must be more, Banders persisted, drawing a glower from Insha Kaforna.
Leave him, she said. This hurts him much.
You can hear Lord Valen's thoughts? Frentis asked Lerniel in a gentler tone. The brother shook his head. Brother Canis only. It's easier that way. He gave a wan smile, but to wade through even the most disciplined mind is a tiring task.
Frentis nodded his thanks and rose from the man's side, moving away to confer with Banders and Solis.
3 days until Winterfall Eve, the Baron said. Scant time for planning. I've had my lot fell the few trees around here for ladders and engines, but none are ready yet.
Which makes the sewers our only option, Frentis said. We know from Darnell's knights that Aspect Alera and Dendrish are in the Blackhold. Perhaps Aspect Arlin, too. I don't give much for their chances if the city is attacked. I can secure them if you'll allow me.
Securing a gate is more important, Solis said. The Aspects are aware that the Faith occasionally requires sacrifice. We will secure a gate to allow Baron Bander's knights into the city, then make for the Blackhold.
We, brother?
Solis's gaze was steady, yielding no room for argument.
Brother, you have led your company well, and they are loyal to you. But your loyalty is to me. Or are you no longer willing to call yourself a brother?
I will never call myself anything else, Frentis returned, anger rising to colour his face.
Solis merely blinked and turned to the Baron. We'll set out at dawn, which should enable us to approach the city under dark in 3 nights.
He looked at Frentis. Choose your people and be ready. They followed the brine wash towards Varenthold, moving in single file along the bank, which was damp enough to prevent any betraying dust cloud. Frentis chose Devoka, Draker, and 34 to accompany him through the sewers, provoking Arundel and Ilion to loud protests at being excluded. Devoka sternly rebuked the lady for her petulance, and Banders refused to even countenance the thought of Arundel leaving his sight.
You'll stay by me at all times, he told his grandson. If this goes right, the fief will have need of a new lord by the week's end.
They stopped after a 2-day trek, occupying a shallow dip in the ground just south of the brine wash. Varenthold out of sight just over the horizon. Solis's brothers scouted the surrounding country, mostly grass and expanses of ash left by the demise of the Earlish. They returned at nightfall, reporting the Valerians seemed to have abandoned patrolling.
Could be they've no cavalry left for such duty, Owen suggested. We killed hundreds back at the spur.
They settled down to rest as night set in, huddling in cloaks against the chill as fires could not be risked. Frentis sat watching the others sleep, determined to stay awake, as he had for the past 2 nights, fighting exhaustion with every step. At one point, he had snapped awake, finding himself held in the saddle by Devoka, shaking his head at her stern entreaties to rest come the night.
She waits for me there, he knew with a cold certainty.
Will it end tomorrow, brother?
It was Ilion sitting a few feet away, swaddled in a cloak taken from a dead Valerian at the spur.
It covered her easily, leaving only the pale oval of her face peering out from the hood.
So young, Frentis thought. So small. You would never know, as no one knew when they looked at her.
Annoyed by the comparison, he looked away.
Will what end? He asked, keeping his voice low.
The war, she said, shuffling closer. Draker said it'll all be over come the new day.
She gave a rueful smile.
Then he said he'd buy a whorehouse with his spoils.
I doubt there are any left to buy, my lady.
But we'll be done. The war will end.
I hope so.
She seemed oddly deflated by this, a flicker of her increasingly rare pout on her lips.
No more Gorin, she murmured. No more Devoka.
Arundel will go off and rule his fief, Draker to his whorehouse, you to the Order.
And you, my lady?
I don't know. I have no idea if my father lives, if his house still stands.
And your mother?
Elin's expression soured a little. Father used to tell me she died when I was little. One day I heard two of the maids gossiping. Seems my darling mother took off with a sea captain when I was no more than a year old. Father had every scrap of clothing she owned stripped from the house, along with every image of her. I don't even know what she looked like.
Not all are suited to parentage, Frentis said, thinking of his own family, if they could be called that.
Whatever your father's fate, his lands and assets are now yours by right. I feel sure the Queen will see to proper restitution in due course.
Restitution?
She looked around at the surrounding fields of ash, rendered silver blue in the moonlight. Is that even possible now? So much has been broken. Besides, I'm not sure I want to regain ownership of an empty ruin.
Arundel, Frentis began in a cautious tone, you seem fond of him.
She gave a soft sigh of embarrassed exasperation.
I am. He's very sweet. And one day I expect Lady Ulis will find him a wife suited to fine dresses and balls and empty talk with privileged fools.
I am not.
Not now, if I ever was.
She wriggled in the folds of her cloak, hefting her crossbow, her hands tight on the stock.
I'm made for this. I'm made for the Order, brother.
He could only stare at her completely serious expression.
There are no sisters of the Sixth Order, he said, lost for any other response.
Why not?
There just aren't. There never have been.
Because only men fight wars?
She nodded at Devoka.
What about her? What about me?
He shifted uncomfortably, lowering his gaze.
The composition of the orders is set down by the tenets of the faith. They can't simply be cast aside.
They could if you were to vouch for me. Especially if Brother Solis were to add his voice.
Everything has changed.
I've heard you say so yourself.
This is a foolish notion, Ilian.
Why is it foolish?
Do you want to be like me?
He leaned forward, eyes locked on hers, suddenly angered by her naivety.
Do you have any notion of what I have done?
You're a great warrior, and the man who saved my life.
Seeing her mystified, wide-eyed gaze, he sighed, his anger evaporating as he slumped back.
I have killed my way across half the world to return to this realm. And when the Queen comes to claim her throne, she'll make sure I face a reckoning.
For what?
Winning the war?
He just shook his head.
I was once just like you, lost, seeking a home, begging the same favor from someone who came to hate himself for saying yes.
And I find myself with a surfeit of hate, my lady.
Approach Brother Solis if you wish. He will say the same thing.
We'll see, she muttered, falling into a sullen silence.
He watched her put the crossbow aside and pluck a bolt from her quiver, working the iron-headed barb on a small whetstone.
No, he conceded. No longer made for dresses and balls.
Did you know, he said, in the southern jungles of the Valyrian Empire, there lives a beast, fully 12 feet tall and covered all over with fur, that looks just like a man on stilts.
She angled her head at him, raising an eyebrow.
You're making it up.
No, it's true. I swear on the faith.
And in the oceans to the east are great sharks, as big as a whale and striped red from end to end.
I've heard of those, she admitted. My tutor showed me a picture once.
Well, I've seen them.
There's more than war to find in this world, Ilian.
There's as much beauty as there is ugliness, as long as you have the eyes to see it.
She gave a small laugh.
Perhaps I'll find a sea captain of my own one day. Go looking for it.
The words were empty, he knew. The humor forced. Her mind was set on but one course.
I hope so, too.
He saw her frown as she scanned his face, youthful beauty marred by concern.
You must sleep, brother. Please.
I'll watch you. If you start to get upset,
I'll wake you. There are some dreams you can't wake from. But he was so tired now, and a battle waited no more than 3 hours hence. Don't neglect your own rest, he told her, settling onto his side, breathing deep, then closing his eyes. She sits alone in a spacious chamber of marble floors and fine furnishings. It is mid-afternoon, and a gentle breeze sways the lace curtains hanging over the arches leading to the balcony. The chamber belonged to Councilman Lorvec, and is filled with artifacts bought or stolen from all corners of the world. Alperin statuary of bronze and marble, fine paintings from the Unified Realm, exquisite ceramics from the Far West, garish war masks from the Southern Tribe lands. A priceless collection, the fruit of several lifetimes' labor. It is how they persist, these select few red-clad, filling their endless days with successive obsession for art, wealth, flesh, or murder. She casts a glance around Lorvec's collection and decides to have it all destroyed the following morning. The feeding 2 days ago has left her invigorated but with a sour edginess. The gifted had been foul indeed, a nondescript man of middle years with the ability to hold a person in place, frozen, immobile, but awake. He had spent over 2 decades wandering the Empire, killing women, freezing them so they could only suffer in silence as he visited all manner of torments upon their flesh. He would have been a useful recruit for the ally, given enough time, but his mind was far too fractured to justify the effort needed. He had tried to resist her, somehow sensing the threat despite the drugs, casting his gift at her like the flailing invisible hand of an addled drunk. She would have laughed at him once, even retreated for a while to allow the drug haze to fade, before returning to enjoy his impotent rage as she made it last. But she hadn't. The stumbling wretch deserved little regard and certainly no pity. But the blood had tasted foul as she slashed his throat, fighting a reflexive gag as she forced herself to drink deep, wondering if all the death she had wrought would also taint her blood. She forces the memory away and slows her breathing, calming her mind, focusing her thoughts. I feel you, beloved, she tells him. I know you feel me too. She waits, mind open to a response, knowing he is there, but feeling only the depth of his enmity. Will you not talk to me? She implores. Are you not lonely too? And we have shared so much. Anger swells, reaching across the great divide to lash at her, making her wince. I fear for you, she persists. We know she lives, beloved. We know she comes to take the city, and you know what she will do when she finds you. The anger dims, replaced by grim acceptance and a great depth of guilt. Forget all the nonsense they instilled in you, she begs. All the lies they told you. The faith is a child's illusion, nobility a coward's mask. They are not for such as us, my love. You felt it, when we were killing together. I know you did. We soared above them all, and we can do so again. Leave now. Run. Come back to me. The sensation changes, emotion fading to be replaced by an image, a darkly beautiful young woman, half her face bathed in firelight, her brow creased in confusion and regret. Her lips move, but the sound is lost to her, although she knows the words with absolute clarity. I made my bargain, beloved. I cannot make another. I had no choice, she tells him now. The image fades, swirling in her mind until it transforms into a voice, hard and cold, but blessedly familiar. Neither do I. They mustered 2 hours shy of dawn, gathering around Solis as he unfurled a recently drawn map of the city, pointing to the northeast gate. I suggest an attack in 2 directions, my lord, he said to Banders. Your knights to press a charge along Gate Lane. It's wide enough for 10 men abreast, and leads directly to the harbour. If successful, you'll cut the city in 2, and sow confusion in the enemy's ranks. My brothers, Brother Frentis's company and the Renfalen common folk, will make for the Blackhold. It's a stout fortress, and will provide a place of retreat should the day go against us.
Banders nodded his agreement and turned to address his assembled captains. "The odds do not favor us, as you know, but we are told Lord Valen comes to take this city, and I intend to aid him in doing so. Tell every knight and man-at-arms that come the morning there will be no turning from the charge. No restraint is to be shown, and no mercy. The city stands infested, and we will cleanse it." He glanced at Arundel, adding in a somber tone, "Lord Darnell is not to be taken alive, regardless of any entreaties to knightly custom. He has forfeited life and knighthood long since." The four of them made their way to the city on foot, heading for the northern stretch of wall, where the brine wash emerged from the city through a great sluice gate. They crawled slowly for the final half mile, Draker grunting along behind and drawing an irritated kick from Davoka. The outlaw had become much stealthier over the months, but often had need of a reminder. As expected, the sluice gate was too well guarded to allow entry, even if it had been possible to navigate the frothing current that slid over the barrier in a constant rush. Instead, Frentis led them into the river and followed the wall north. They wore thin clothing of light fabric, boots having been abandoned before entering the chill waters, their weapons confined to daggers and swords. The pipe emerged from the wall 3 feet above the water, where the river began to arc away from the city and commence its long winding journey into the heart of the realm. A continual stream of effluent flowed from the pipe, leaving a foul-smelling stain on the river that had Draker gagging as they swam through it. Frentis hugged the wall, eyes fixed on the parapet above, finding it empty, though there was the faint murmur of Valerian voices nearby. He had discounted this exit when they escaped the city during the invasion, given the ease with which archers would have picked them off as soon as they emerged. Now he gambled on its vulnerability, doubting even a soul as cautious as Blood Rose would see much threat in so exposed an entry point. He moved along the wall, hands exploring for holds, but finding nothing. "It's too slippy, brother," Draker whispered next to his ear, his large hand scraping moss from the stone. Frentis turned as 34 tapped his shoulder. The former slave patted his chest and pointed to the mouth of the pipe, then made an upward pushing motion with both arms. Frentis took another look at the moss-covered wall and gave a reluctant nod. The splash of disturbed water would have to be risked if they were to continue. He and Devoke moved to either side of 34, drawing breath, then sinking under the water. Frentis took hold of the man's slim leg and placed the foot on his shoulder, counted to three to ensure Devoke was similarly prepared, reached out to slap her arm, and they both kicked upwards in unison, boosting 34 out of the water to clamp his hands on the rim of the pipe. He hung there for a few seconds as they scanned the wall above, waiting for any sign of discovery. Nothing. Even the murmur of voices seemed to have gone. 34 levered himself onto the top of the pipe and caught the coiled rope Frentis threw him, looping it over the great iron tube and tying it tight with his usual facility for knots. Draker hauled himself up first, squirming into the pipe and biting down curses at the filth now piling up in front of him. It took several anxious moments before his head finally disappeared into the pipe. Devoka followed him, grunting as she heaved herself into the opening, pushing Draker's bulk ahead of her. Frentis gestured for 34 to follow, then climbed up, casting a final glance at the walls as he undid the rope from the pipe, dragging it behind as he squirmed through. "Nothing beats the smell of home, eh, brother?" Draker asked as he emerged into the sewers. The big outlaw stood in the channel of rushing filth, casting his gaze right and left. "Reckon it's this way," he said, pointing right. "Channel loops back around towards the gate, as I recall." "Lead on," Frentis told him. It took over an hour of sloshing through the polluted water and a couple of wrong turns before they came to the requisite drain. It was an iron grate 20 feet from the north gate, with a narrow opening where the inner wall met the road. Frentis remembered slipping through the opening with relative ease one time, many years ago, when he had run from a vengeful shop owner. Now, however, even 34 found the opening too narrow. "There's a wider one on Firestone Way," Draker recalled. "Too far," Frentis said. He peered through the opening at the wasted streets beyond, finding a series of jagged silhouettes
collapsed walls, and burnt-out buildings, devoid of good cover. The sky above now a grey-blue, signifying a fast-approaching sunrise. They'll see our approach. He pulled a dagger from his belt and started chipping at the mortar around the bricks forming the opening, the others soon joining in. Softly, he cautioned Draker as the big man jabbed his short sword hard into the mortar. Sunrise had come on by the time they loosened enough brick to allow egress, long shadows stretching from the ruins as they hauled themselves free. Frentis led them from shadow towards the gate, finding it manned by a dozen Varitai. "We should have taken Ilion with us," Draker grumbled in a whisper. "She'd pick off a few in short order." Frentis beckoned to 34. "We need a distraction." The former slave nodded, sheathing his short sword and rising to run towards the gate, gesticulating wildly. "The general!" he called in Valerian as the Varitai stirred, moving to confront him with swords drawn. "He calls for you!" 34 went on, pointing towards the southern quarter. "Slaves are in revolt! You must come!" As expected, they just stood regarding him in silence. Varitai were conditioned to respond only to orders given by their officers, and there was no chance they would follow his commands. However, they were still compelled to look in his direction as he scurried away, halting and beckoning madly. "Come, come, or I'll be flayed!" A tired-looking free-sword sergeant emerged from the gatehouse, rubbing bleary eyes and buckling on his sword as he took in the sight of the desperate slave. "What the fuck do you want?" Frentis nodded to the others and slipped from their shadow, crawling closer under concealment of a low pile of blackened bricks, no more than 15 feet from the gate. "A revolt, honored citizen," 34 said to the sergeant, an impressively convincing whine coloring his voice. "Please! Oh, please!" "Shut up!" the sergeant said wearily, moving towards 34, clearly puzzled by his clothing, mean even for a slave, and the sight of his sword. "Who gave you that? Give it here." "Certainly, honored sir," 34 said as the sergeant reached for his sword, drawing it in a single fluid motion and flicking the blade across the man's eyes. 34 stepped nimbly past him as he collapsed to his knees, screaming and clutching at his face, killing a Varitai with a thrust to the neck, then turning and running. 6 Varitai took off in pursuit, one falling dead with Frentis's throwing knife in his throat, 2 more quickly hacked down by Davoka and Draker. Frentis hefted a spear dropped by the Varitai he had killed, hurling it at his onrushing comrade with enough force to pierce his breastplate. 34 skidded to a halt, pivoted, and delivered a precise cut to the leg of the Varitai chasing him, Draker's blow nearly decapitating the slave soldier as he fell. "Stay close," Frentis ordered, scooping up a fallen blade and charging for the gate, a sword in each hand. The 5 remaining Varitai formed a tidy defensive knot, impassive faces behind levelled spears. Frentis threw his left-hand sword at the one in the centre, the blade sinking into his face just beneath his helmet. Frentis leapt through the gap, slashing left and right, the others moving in to finish those he wounded. A pain-filled yell drew his gaze, and he found Draker on his back, parrying thrusts from a Varitai's spear, a newly earned gash on his forehead. Davoka moved to help him, but the outlaw proved his hard-won skills by rolling under the Varitai's guard to stab at his groin, spoiling the accomplishment somewhat by proceeding to bring the slave soldier down with a series of frenzied blows, obscenities flowing from his snarling lips in a torrent. "Raise the gate," Frentis told Davoka, making for the steps leading to the parapet. He found 2 free swords there, youthful faces aghast at the carnage they had witnessed below, pointing their swords at him with trembling hands. "Fight or run," Frentis told them in Valerian. "You'll die today in either case." They ran, sprinting away across the parapet without a backward glance. "Tell your comrades the Red Brother's here!" Frentis yelled after them before turning to pull a torch from a stanchion. He hopped onto the battlement and waved the torch back and forth, peering into the misted fields beyond the walls. A few heartbeats later he saw it, a single torch flaring to life, burning brighter as the bearer came closer. And 2,000 Renfalian knights resolved out of the mist at full gallop. Banders was clearly visible at the head of the tight column,
his faux-rusted armour catching the rising sun, Arundel and Ermund on either side of him. They thundered through the gate without pause, the clatter of steel-shod hooves on cobbles rising to a deafening pitch as they charged along Gate Lane. A few Varitai came running from the western quarter to oppose them, a single company managing to form ranks across the lane before being smashed aside by the tide of horse and steel.
"Brother!" Frentis looked down from the gatehouse, finding a grinning Ivan there, mounted, with Frentis's horse at his side. "The Blackhold awaits!"
The squat fortress was already in uproar when they got there, two Varitai lying dead at the main gate and several more inside. They were obliged to fight their way into the courtyard as more guards came rushing from a maze of shadowed doorways. Mostly Varitai, with a few free swords showing none of the cowardice of their comrades on the wall. Solis took his brothers up the stairs and into the upper levels, clearing the archers from the parapet and sending their own arrows down on the defenders below. Frentis led his company from doorway to doorway, Draka breaking them open as they searched for the aspects, finding only more Valerians, most willing to fight, others cowering, but all destined to die. He was emerging from a storeroom when a Curitai appeared out of the shadows, twin short swords flashing. Frentis parried his first blow, but slipped on a patch of blood, tumbling to the flagstones, the Curitai looming above, then falling dead when a crossbow bolt punched through his breastplate.
"Not like you to be so clumsy, brother," Ilion observed from across the courtyard, words garbled somewhat by the bolt held between her teeth as she braced the crossbow against her midriff to draw the string back.
He was about to tell her to join Brother Solis on the parapet, but found his attention drawn to a commotion rising from a half-open door at the rear of the courtyard. He went to it, finding a set of steps leading into the bowels of the Blackhold. He called to Devoka to follow, and took the stairs at a run. At the base of the steps, he found a dead free sword, with what appeared to be steel darts embedded in both eyes. Beside him lay the body of a man in a bedraggled city guard uniform, bloodied sword in hand and belly rent open. In the chamber beyond the stairwell lay three Varitai, steel darts jutting from their necks. Beyond them, a young woman was grappling with a burly freesword, blood streaming from her nose and eyes as he forced her to her knees, short sword inching towards her throat. Frentis drew his sword back for a throw, but Ilion was faster, sending a bolt into the Valerian's temple before he could bring his blade to bear. The woman slumped beneath the collapsing free sword, blood bubbling on her lips as she issued a groan of near complete exhaustion. Frentis hauled the corpse away and helped her upright, finding her eyes still bright despite the paleness of her skin.
"My brother," she whispered.
"Brother?"
"Relkin. City guard."
Frentis shook his head, and the woman moaned in sorrow, blinking red tears before speaking again.
"Aspects, are they safe?"
He cast his gaze around the chamber, taking in the sight of the cells. From one of them, he could hear an implacable thumping noise, a voice within shouting something unintelligible, but with an odd note of authority.
"Search the bodies," he told Ilion. "Find the keys."
Aspect Dendrish stood still and straight-backed as the doors swung open, face rigid and composed, though his rapidly blinking eyes told of a man expectant of a swift death.
"Aspect," Frentis greeted him with a bow. "Brother Frentis, I doubt you remember, but we met at my test of knowledge."
The aspect seemed to deflate, issuing an explosive sigh of relief and doubling over, as much as his bulk would allow.
"Where is Aspect Alera?" he demanded after a moment, raising a haggard face that somehow managed to retain a vestige of the imperious self-regard Frentis recalled.
"Brother Frentis," she said as the door opened, sitting on her bed, smiling in welcome, her hands clasped in her lap.
"How you've grown! Is Lucius with you?"
There was a pounding of running feet, and Ivan appeared at the door to the cell, his grin even wider than usual.
"Brother Solis sends his regards, Aspects," he said, nodding briefly at them in turn before addressing Frentis. "He says to gather your people and forget about holding this place. We need to get to the docks."
Chapter 12. Valin. "Have I ever told you," Norta began, his pallor somewhat grey in the dim light of the hold. "How much I detest sea travel." Behind him, one of his fighters gave a grunt of agreement before heaving into his helmet. "Do it in the bilges," Norta rebuked him. "You'll have to wear that before long." Venn gave his brother a soft pat on the arm and moved deeper into the hold, passing ranks of free fighters dressed in Valerian armor, taking the steps to the lower deck where the Sjorda sat in equal misery. He found Hera Drakil sitting next to a half-open porthole, eyes closed and mouth open to suck in the sweet outside air. "We're 5 miles from the harbor," Valen told him, drawing a puzzled frown. "We'll be there soon," he clarified. "Make your people ready." "They've been ready to get off this horrible thing since they stepped on it," the war chief returned with a baleful glint in his eye. Without Durenna's guidance, persuading them to this stratagem had not been an easy thing. He had explained it all in detail to Hera Drakil, the queen adding her voice with promises of great rewards and everlasting gratitude should they consent to take the ship to Varenshold. The Sjorda listened to it all in silence, then walked back to his people's encampment. Valen and Lerna lingered on the periphery, watching the argument unfold. The Sjorda were not a demonstrative people, rarely given to raised voices or gesticulation, so there had been a certain ominous quality to the increasing stillness and quietude evident in the various war chiefs as they sat in a circle and debated the merits of Valen's plan. Eventually, after several hours, and with night coming on, Hera Drakil returned, his face rigid with reluctance, as he said, "We go on the big water." "Salt staining every breath," the Sjorda said now. "No earth beneath your feet. How can such a thing be born for any time?" "Greed or necessity," Valen replied. "You recall your part in this? Kill all the two swords we find, and make for the big black building." The Sjorda stirred as Valen rose, leaning forward, fixing him with the same questing gaze he had shown him since Altor. "What is he looking for?" Valen wondered again as the war chief's eyes met his. "Does he ponder if there's another soul behind these eyes? Or is it more what I may have brought back?" "You." The Sjorda paused, searching for the right words. "You are more. You, now, Beryl Shak-Ur." Valen replied with a cautious nod. In truth, he felt stronger, the chill having lifted from his bones, for the most part. Also, his final practice with Davin had actually seen him defeat the shipwright, much to his sister's delight. She had taken to watching the daily contests, and gave a squeal of triumph as Valen's wooden sword found a gap in Davin's defences, jabbing into his midriff with enough force to provoke an obscenity-laden shout of pain. His dark-faced fury at Alornis's taunts had been something of a guilty pleasure, though Valen was careful to hide it as he thanked the sergeant for his service and released him from future obligations. "I am," Davin grated, "always at your disposal, my lord." He made his way to the top deck and joined Reva at the helm, dressed in her light mail shirt, sword on her back, and bow in hand, laughing at something the shield had said. The man's humour faded at sight of Valen, and he beckoned his helmsman forward to take the wheel, offering a cursory bow. "My lord of battle." "Fleet Lord Alnestra," Valen replied, bowing lower. The shield's resentment was more carefully hidden than Davin's, though he suspected no less deeply felt. "Our pet savages are prepared, I take it?" Alnestra asked. "Don't call them that," Valen told him, annoyed at the ease with which the shield provoked him. "Defeat and humiliation are poor tutors, it seems." "Your pardon, my lord, though you must agree they make poor sailors." "Who can blame them?" Reva said, her face only slightly less grey than Norta's. "I'd fight half the world to get off this tub." "Tub?" The shield rounded on her in mock fury. "My lady insults the finest vessel ever taken by a Maldinian sabre. Why, I would challenge you if you were not merely but a feeble woman." He took the lightning slap she gave him with good grace, making her laugh again with a florid bow before striding off to order his first mate to muster a fighting party. "I thought at least she'd be immune to his charms,"
Valen thought sourly. "Your people are ready?" he asked her. She jerked her head at the rigging above, Valen seeing the densely packed archers on the platforms at the top of the great ship's two towering masts. A figure leaned over